All right, the Giants go for the sweep of the Fightin' Phils today, and we'll see if Carlos Rodon can get it done, the lefty. And he goes against Ranger Suarez, an excellent fielder. I think you'll enjoy this game today. Well, a pleasure to bring our next guest onto the show. We're honored to have him. It is David Maranis, M-A-R-A-N-I-S-S. His book is Path Lit by Lightning, The Life of Jim Thorpe. It's an amazing story, but let me tell you something about David, so please sit down while I say this. David Maranis is an associate editor at the Washington Post and a distinguished visiting professor at Vanderbilt University. He's won 2 Pulitzer Prizes for journalism and was a finalist 3 other times. Among his outstanding books, the best-selling books, are biographies of Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, Roberto Clemente, and Vince Lombardi. How about that for a lineup? And a trilogy about the 1960s, Rome 1960, Once in a Great City, and They Marched into Sunlight. You can visit David at davidmaranis.com, and he is a Pulitzer Prize finalist 3 times. It's what a career. David, it's a pleasure to have you with us. Did I say enough about you?
Too much, my man. But by the way, I'm happy to be with you, and I'm delighted that the Giants are beating the Phils because I'm a Brewers fan.
Oh, very good. Well, we're going to have Rowdy Tellezes on the show later today. Hit a big home run yes. Last night. Northern California kid.
Boy, did we need it. The Brewers are really struggling.
Yes, they are. And Corbin Burns got hit again, and you're going to see the Giants and Brewers. We'll do a little baseball here before the book. You'll see the Giants and the Brewers next Thursday for a doubleheader in Milwaukee. How about that?
Yep, that's great. Yeah.
Okay, now, Path Lit by Lightning, The Life of Jim Thorpe, and it's a fabulous book. It's an amazing story. Why Jim Thorpe for you? How come?
Well, you know, Marty, I look at it as the third in my trilogy on sports figures who transcend sports. You know, Lombardi was a great coach, but he was also sort of a role model in leadership, and it was a way to explore the mythology of competition and success in American life and what it takes and what it costs. Roberto Clemente, this beautiful ball player, but also that rare athlete who actually was a hero. So many athletes are called heroes, but Clemente lived a heroic life and died trying to deliver humanitarian aid to Nicaragua after an earthquake in a plane crash. And then I viewed Jim Thorpe as a way not only to write about this athlete with unparalleled talents. I mean, there are a lot of great athletes in American history, but no one before or since has been a gold medalist in the decathlon and pentathlon, an All-American football player, the first great professional football player, the first president of what would become the National Football League, and a Major League Baseball player. All of that is unparalleled. But I also saw it as a chance to write about the Native American experience through his life. He was born in Sac and Fox Territory in Oklahoma, and all the obstacles he had to face in his life are representative of what all Native Americans did.
Tell us a little bit about his early life, because he ends up at the Carlisle Institute, of course, for Native Americans, and it's a major part of his development. And a lot of people don't understand what was going on at that period of United States history and how the Carlisle School became part of it.
You know, it's a complicated issue, Marty, because it's because of the Carlisle Indian Industrial School that Thorpe became famous. That's where he was an All-American football player and where he went on to win the gold medals. But the school's basic motto was kill the Indian, save the man, which meant take away all of their culture, their religion, their language, cut their hair and dress them in the uniforms of the U.S. Cavalry, try to make them as white as possible, and really forced assimilation. And that was actually the government policy throughout the period of Jim Thorpe's life.
So how did Thorpe adjust to that? How did he work things out at Carlisle?
He worked it out because he was a great athlete. And you know, a great athlete often gets treated differently than others. But plus, he was just so focused on the sports that it made it easier for him to endure it. He had a great football coach, Pop Warner, for whom, youth football is named. That Carlisle Indian team would beat all of the great teams in college football in that era, which, you know, it wasn't Alabama and Oklahoma. It was Yale and Princeton and Harvard and West Point. But Carlisle could beat them all.
The title of the book is Path Lit by Lightning, and is the life of Jim Thorpe. David Moranis is our guest. How did you come up with the title for the book, David?
Jim Thorpe was born in 1887 in Indian Territory of what would become Oklahoma. The night of his birth, and actually, by the way, he was a twin. His twin brother, Charlie, sadly died at a boarding school at age 9. But anyway, the night of their birth, there was a thunderstorm along the North Canadian River. And his parents named him Wathohawk in the Sac and Fox language. And that can be translated to Path Lit by Lightning, which, well, as soon as I saw that, I said, that illuminates the whole story.
All right, let's talk a little bit about his athletic career, because this is really the crux of the story, and then, of course, what goes on in his later life. But let's talk about his athletic abilities in football and baseball and how it translated into the Olympic medals.
Well, yeah, he could do all three of those things. He was probably best at football, actually. He played 60 minutes, as they all did in that era. He not only was a great halfback and defensive back, but also a terrific punter. He could punt at 70 yards routinely, 80 yards. And he was also a place kicker and drop kicker. So literally, there was nothing in football he couldn't do. That was also true in track and field. You know, the decathlon is 10 events. He won the gold medal in that, you know, running, throwing, and jumping. The pentathlon, he also won 5 events, competed in 15 events in 2 weeks, plus 2 other individual events, won those gold medals, was declared the best athlete in the world by the King of Sweden. And then there was baseball, which he played. You know, it was not his best sport. He was definitely better than Michael Jordan. He was a major leaguer, and he got better as his career progressed. But I think he was somewhat mishandled. And as you know, he played for the New York Giants, the predecessors of the San Francisco Giants, for most of his baseball career.
Boy, the big problem for Jim Thorpe turns out that he played baseball in the summers. This is before the Olympics, and of course you had to be an amateur and all this. But the young people from Carlisle would go down south and play in the D leagues of North Carolina, what have you, for small amounts of money. Everyone at Carlisle knew it. Pop Warner knew it. And he goes down and plays some baseball, and that comes to be his undoing with the Olympic medals.
Absolutely right. Not only did Pop Warner knew it, but there were literally scores of college athletes who were playing minor league baseball in that era, Bush League baseball, for about $2 a game or $30 a month. But they were mostly playing under aliases. Dwight Eisenhower played in the Kansas State League under the name Wilson. There were so many aliases in the Eastern Carolina League where Jim played that it was called the Pocahontas League because everybody was named John Smith. But Jim Thorpe played under the name Jim Thorpe. He never tried to hide it. Pop Warner knew what he was doing. It was Pop Warner's good friend in Pennsylvania who was the scout who sent many of those Carlisle Indian athletes down there. He talked with Jim several times during that period. James E. Sullivan, the president of the Amateur Athletic Union and also the American Olympic, U.S. Olympic Committee, was also on the board of advisors for the Carlisle Athletic Association. He knew, and both of them, to save their own reputations, claimed complete innocence and didn't know what Jim Thorpe was doing. So many supposed amateurs were doing things like that, but it was Jim Thorpe that was picked out as sort of the fall guy for it all.
And all this is meticulously researched by David Moranis in this wonderful biography, really a wonderful, I learned so much in reading it. All right, so now Jim Thorpe plays some ball down in the Carolinas, and he goes to the Olympics in 1912, and he's acclaimed the greatest athlete in the world. He gets all sorts of his medals and loving cups and things like that. And then all of a sudden, the word comes out, accidentally by some writer up in the East Coast, says, you know, I think he played some baseball as a professional. And boy, everyone turns on him at that point, and he loses his medals. And this is a crux of what the story's all about.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it had been in the weird part is, it had been reported in the press in North Carolina for years that when he was playing down there, you know, because he used his real name, but only in 1913, after he won his gold medals, when a reporter for the Worcester Telegram told the story of a manager who had who had managed Jim in North Carolina, did it become that big deal? And so, yes, he lost his medals, and it took, think about this, Marty, it took 110 years for him to get his justice restored. It only happened this last year, last month, actually.
Well, and to put it in context, we always remember Leonard Coppett always taught me this. You got to put it in context of the times. Here's a Native American, and he's declared the greatest athlete, not just in his state or the country, in the world. And he gets parades and all sorts of accolades all along. And then when the news gets out, they take everything away from him. And that is just amazing to me. But now baseball comes into his life. And John McGraw of the Giants sees, like they did in those days, a drawing card. McGraw was a vaudevillian at some point. And the part I like about the story, and it's so well done, when they signed him in 1913, they decided to go on a tour of the world with the Chicago White Sox. And they went to the Far East, they went to the Mideast, they went to Europe. And why did they go? Because the whole world knew of Jim Thorpe. How about that part?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there were a lot of John McGraw was well-known in the United States. Charles Comiskey, the owner of the White Sox, was. There were two Hall of Famers on the trip, Tris Speaker and Sam Crawford. But the rest of the world didn't know any of them. The one person they knew because of the Olympics was Jim Thorpe. So he was the drawing card everywhere they went, from, as you said, Japan and China to Australia to Europe. And, you know, even at the Vatican, all of the cardinals, they didn't, under the Pope, they didn't want to see any of the ballplayers. They wanted to meet Jim Thorpe.
Now, these were not the St. Louis Cardinals, right?
That's why I said under the Pope. Yeah, right.
All right. So now Jim Thorpe, of course, and John McGraw uses him sparingly. You know, he sits on the bench and they put him in occasionally. And he eventually goes to the minor leagues and then comes back with the Boston Braves and actually almost leads the league in hitting. That was sort of the high watermark of his baseball career.
It was the high watermark, and it was really the last year of him playing in the majors. What an odd career he had. You're right. I mean, after McGraw signed him, probably in part for publicity reasons, although I think he also did think that he could teach Thorpe how to play baseball, but he never gave him the shot. You know, he would sit on the bench in New York for all of those years. Once he was sent to the minors a couple of times, did fine there, went to play for the Cincinnati Reds under Christy Mathewson, you know, the great former Giant pitcher, and then was shipped back to New York. And then finally, as he said, in 1919, he was with the Boston Braves. He played every day, and he was great. He led the league in hitting almost the entire year. He was in the newspapers in Boston, you know, every day with his crosstown rival, Babe Ruth. He was ahead of Ty Cobb for most of the year hitting. So, you know, it was when he got his shot, he did really well, which made me think that if only he'd been sort of handled better through the course of his baseball career, he could have become a really very good player.
What a story. It's we talk about, well, he was signed as a baseball player. It sounds like Bo Jackson or something like that. But this man was the greatest athlete in the world. And now he's in baseball because he's got to make a living because he's now been declared a professional. And he loses his Olympic medals as the greatest athlete in the world. And now he's sitting on the bench for the New York Giants, of course, and become the San Francisco Giants in 1958. Now, parallel to this, and this is what makes the story great, and you do such a good job of explaining this, his football career takes off. And as you said in the open, he becomes one of the great football players of all time and the first president of what will become the NFL. How about that?
Yeah, it's important to understand the role of pro football during that era. It was a secondary sport. You know, it was way below Major League Baseball. And, you know, even tennis and boxing and horse racing and golf. So it was really when Thorpe came to play in what was called the Ohio League in 1915 with the Canton Bulldogs that football historians say that the sport really started to rise for the first time. And he was the player coach for the Canton Bulldogs, led them to several world championships. The league finally evolved from the ragtag Ohio League into what would become the National Football League. And again, because he was so well known, Thorpe was named the first president of that league. He didn't really have any administrative duties, but they needed his name to make football seem, the equal of the other sports. So he was great in football. He's in the first class in the Pro Football Hall of Fame in Canton, where he starred.
Boy, playing against George Halas, Newt Rockne, and people like that. It's just incredible to be playing Major League Baseball and be this type of football player and the greatest athlete in the world. And by the way, we're going to take all your medals away because you played minor league baseball in 1910. It's really just outrageous what happened to him. There's a chapter in the book called Lo, the Poor Indian. Tell us about that.
Well, that's the chapter about how he lost his medals and why and how unfair it was. And there's so many aspects to that. I mean, first of all, Marty, what does it mean to be an amateur? One of his fellow athletes on the 1912 Olympic team was George S. Patton, who would become the great, the famous general of World War II. Well, Patton competed in what was called the modern pentathlon, which was a bunch of army military style events, shooting and fencing and equestrian. And he was paid by the U.S. Army to train for those events the whole time. Is that being a professional or an amateur? Jim Thorpe was paid to play baseball, which he didn't even do in the Olympics. Lo, the Poor Indian was a phrase that actually came from a poem by Alexander Pope centuries earlier, but the sports writers, for some reason, in the early 20th century, sort of latched onto that phrase and applied it to Native Americans no matter what they were doing, good or bad. So Lo, the Poor Indian was sort of Jim Thorpe's fate.
Did anyone ever defend him and say this is wrong, what they were doing to Jim Thorpe?
Absolutely. It was really just the powers that be in the Olympic and amateur athletic movement that were against him. But all of the sports writers, virtually all of them, led by the famous Grantland Rice, took up Jim's cause and said it was unfair. But they could never get the Olympic figures to budge on it until only recently.
Well, this Avery Brundage is in the middle of this. Of course, he cozied up to Hitler in 1936, and Brundage was part of the team, wasn't he, on Jim Thorpe's Olympic team, and he was a big part of not allowing Jim to have his medals.
Yeah, I mean, I always think of Avery Brundage as this plutocrat, sort of fat cat figure who ran the Olympic Committee from his position of wealth for decades. He actually was a decathlete in those 1912 Olympics, and he was mediocre. Thorpe crushed him. As a matter of fact, Brundage quit before the events were over. He was getting beaten so badly. But then he rose in the Olympic movement to become first the head of the U.S. Olympic Committee and then run the whole shebang, the International Olympic Committee. And for decades, he refused to give Jim Thorpe his justice. Every time the issue came up, he said, no way.
Boy, I'm so glad that you exposed that in the book as well. The other part of Avery Brundage and the whole Olympic Committee, they just never could get over the fact that Jim was this great athlete and that he deserved the respect of the world again. And they just wouldn't let him do it. Well, what happens with the Carlisle School? Because that eventually has a lot of problems, and it's closed up. And Pop Warner sort of sneaks out the back door because he had this slush fund that he was using for years. And, of course, he goes on to be Pop Warner. But Carlisle ends up closing it up.
Yeah, in 1914, there was a congressional investigation of Carlisle that exposed a lot of problems at the school, including a lot of violence against the students. But at the center of it was Pop Warner. It was revealed that he did have a slush fund. He was paying his players. He was selling tickets in hotel lobbies on the side. And he was physically and mentally abusing the players, according to many of them who turned on him at that point, many of the young Indian athletes. So you're right. He was able to slip out of Carlisle untarnished, basically. The rest of the world didn't really pay attention to that investigation. He went to Pitt, where he won two world national championships, undefeated seasons, and then Stanford. And then eventually, as you know, Pop Warner Youth Football, all named for him.
Amazing. Amazing. The book is Path Lit by Lightning, The Life of Jim Thorpe. As you can tell, David Moranis, a wonderful writer, Maraniss. We support our local bookstore in Montclair, The Book Tree. David, I'm sure, has it in the window. And you can get it there. Simon & Schuster published it. So, David, what happens in later life to Jim Thorpe? Because here he is, this wonderful, wonderful two-sport, three-sport athlete, greatest in the world. What happens to the rest of his life?
The rest of his life is a struggle. He was human. He had flaws. He struggled with alcohol. He wasn't home much. He ended up having three wives, seven children, and moving around the country, trying to sort of find stability somewhere. I document that he lived in 20 different states. He took jobs ranging from, at one point, digging ditches during the Depression to serving on a merchant marine ship during World War II. Most of that time, he was in Los Angeles, working on the fringes of the studio of the Hollywood industry. He was an extra in more than 70 movies.
Wow.
And in that period, he became he reestablished his Native American identity as a leader during that period. There are about 200 or 300 Native Americans who were on the fringes of the studio industry trying to get jobs as extras in all of the Westerns that were being produced. And often in those movies, the studios were hiring white people and dressing up in grease paint to play Indians. And so Jim Thorpe said, hire us. And he sort of became the spokesman for that, which seems sort of obvious. But also trying to get the Hollywood to move away from some of the negative stereotypes of Indians, which he faced his whole life. As an athlete, whenever he played, any Indian athlete is called chief. They weren't chiefs. None of them really were. And they were always on the warpath and scalping and all the sort of stereotypes of what white people think Indians are and do.
Mm. Chief Myers, Chief Bender come to mind very
quickly.
In baseball. David, as we wrap it up, he gets his medals back. Finally, he gets justice. Who was the spearhead for making that happen?
Boy, that was a long, long fight. I mean, he sort of got partially restored in 1983 before the L.A. Olympics of 84. But they gave his children replicas of the medals and didn't make him the sole winner of the events. Finally, in July of this year, it happened. And it was a long, long struggle led by, I would say, Anita de France of the International Olympic Committee, and a U.S. Leader of that. She was really instrumental, as were some of the early chroniclers of Thorpe. Bob Wheeler and his wife Florence Ridlund, and so many other people were pushing for this day. And Jim's long gone. All of his children are dead. Many of his grandchildren are in their 70s, are no longer here. But finally, it happened 110 years too late.
Wow! Wow! What a story! Boy, we could go on and on. It's a pleasure having you on. Really. Path Lit by Lightning, David Moranis, two-time Pulitzer Prize award winner, three-time finalist, and other times. A pleasure to have you on, David. Thank you so much for sharing this story. And the book is absolutely, absolutely, I think, one of the best I've read all year, so I appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Marty, and go Giants today.
Yes, they need it, believe me.
Yeah,
all right, have a good afternoon. Thank you, David.
Yep.
All right. That is David Moranis. Wow, what a story. Jim Thorpe is a New York Giant. Come on. All right. It's hard to believe when you read this book, all that happened to Jim Thorpe. All right, Bill and I will kick it around next right here on the Sports Leader.